Good. So, I want to talk a little bit about this themes from a particular paper that you can find on a website that is Subbuti's website. I don't know the actual web address, but if you look up Subbuti, there's a website that he has. And on that website, there's a number of essays. And one of these essays is called A Suprapersonal Force, S-U-P-R-A, suprapersonal. Somebody, some wag, said this time it's suprapersonal. So last week I started to look at a couple of the themes from it. And I'll just do a little bit of a recap and then I'll try and move on. So what the paper's getting at is that, the whole of the Dharma life is about trying to realize a freedom from the constraints of our self-centeredness. Our self-centeredness is based on a delusion, and it keeps our consciousness, our minds, trapped in a narrow, confined, unsatisfactory way. There's a transcendence that's possible from all self-centeredness. A transcendence not just that isn't just based on being good, but a transcendence that's based on a realization that what we thought of as me isn't really true. It's a realization that is a wordless, direct, immediate realization. And it's said to lead to a whole new consciousness, a whole new type of consciousness. Not just me on a good day or you on a good day, but a different category of consciousness, a different quality of consciousness that's so new that Sangharakshita, who's the founder of this centre and this order and this movement, it's so new that he says that the Buddha, it was like he became a new species. It's like the consciousness was so different to ordinary human consciousness, which is all bound up with self, or it's self-referential. Even at its best, it's self-referential. That this new type of transcendent consciousness was so different, it was like a new species was born. And what Buddhism is saying is that all human beings have the capacity or the capability of realizing that transcendent self-consciousness. Now, this paper is saying that it's trying to give a metaphor for what that might feel like, and then saying, well, how might you get there? How might you, or how might this transcendent consciousness arise in you? That might be a better way of putting it. And the metaphor that it uses is that it feels like some other force or some other consciousness or some other will flows through us. It feels as if there's an energy or a force, like an inspiration that comes through. It's when we were looking at it last week, somebody here who's an artist was talking about the inspiration that come through when you're creating something. And it's a bit like that creative inspiration lives through us. So it's not that we disappear exactly. It's not that, you know, we just kind of go away. And it's certainly not like, well, last week I said it's certainly not like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's not something unpleasant, but it's something that is more than us, that we allow quite willingly to come through us. And it feels like a force, an energy, a volition, a will. And it's said that it's always a will that's a will to compassion, a will to love more, an expansive energy that wants to help alleviate suffering wherever it meets suffering, a compassionate force. So we become, as it were, our minds, our ordinary minds, become, as it were, taken over by this transcendent consciousness, this transcendent will to compassion. And it's all also seen as said to be blissful and liberating. So it's not just like feeling worthy or thinking, you know, sort of gritting your teeth and thinking, okay, well, I'll do the washing up. It's not like that. It's actually said to be liberating and blissful and completely energizing. And yet there's a heart that just can't help but love. You might get a tiny, tiny glimmer of it in the fifth stage of the Metta Bhavana. Sometimes it's possible in the fifth stage of the Metta Bhavana to get into a state where the metta is just flowing freely, where it's it can feel as if it's not your metta for all beings. In fact, it can feel as if it's not anything to do with you. It's as if there's just metta in experience. And that metta is like sunlight raining down. Sunlight doesn't rain down, I know. Sunlight shines down on you and on all beings, as if it's always been the case. And all you're doing is opening up to it, acknowledging it. It's as if there's always metta. Metta is there for everybody all the time. Actually, we don't always teach the Metta Bhavana like that, but that experience of metta in the Metta Bhavana, which can arise, is probably more true to how things are from an enlightened perspective than our usual way of thinking, I must now cultivate loving kindness for all beings, which isn't a wrong thing to do. It's not a bad thing to do. In a way, we probably have to start there, but you can get to a state where it's spontaneous and flowing, and it can feel as if it's nothing to do with you. It's just flowing for all beings. So that could be a hint of this force that can come through us. And the reason it's called suprapersonal is because it's not impersonal. Normally, when we think of a force, when we use the language of a force, the word itself can lead you to think of something impersonal, like the force of gravity, or like the force, well, the other natural forces in physics, electromagnetism, or whatever it is. You can think of it as some sort of natural phenomenon that is impersonal. By impersonal, I mean that there's no sense of it being alive or aware. It's blind. It's a sort of inanimate thing. Yeah, it's flowing. That would be impersonal. Or, in our notion of this sort of area, we can have something that's personal. Personal in the sense that it's like a person. That is aware, that is conscious, in the same way as we are aware and conscious. And if you were, if I was teaching theism, if we were Christians, if we were theists, that personal force would be categorized as God. A personal God would be one way of thinking about this sort of personal force. And then you could say the grace of God would flow through. Buddhism is pointing to another category that isn't impersonal like the law of gravity, and isn't personal like most notions of a creator God would be. I know that sometimes people can have different notions of God, and God is such an elastic term that it can cover a huge range. But if I'm just going to use it in this sense of a personal God, a personal creator God, well, Buddhism's pointing to something other than that. It's pointing to something beyond the impersonal and the personal, to something transpersonal, something that is alive, aware of the nation, of the nature of consciousness, but isn't just another being, isn't just another being, no matter how exalted. It's of the nature of a universal force, a universal truth, and yet that universal truth is also aware. It's also of the nature of love. So the term that's been used here is supra-personal, more than personal. Not less than personal, which is what impersonal would be, but more than personal. Now, more than personal, in a certain sense, we don't really know what that is. You have to touch it. You have to be exhilarated and charged by a supra-personal inspiration to know what it is. Just suffice to say that it's beyond our normal experience of me and mine. Yeah. And it's not an inanimate thing. It's not inanimate. And yet it is natural. It is natural. So that's the metaphor, and it is a metaphor. It's really, really important to remember it's a metaphor and not to confuse it for doctrine. Buddhism tries to stay wise to the use of metaphors, to the use of language, to the use of images, and tries not to mistake that for doctrine. As soon as we mistake it for doctrine, we literalize it, and then we think that there really is something out there called a suprapersonal force, like some sort of superhero, and all I have to do is open up to it and it'll come through me, as if it was a literal truth. It's not quite like that. This is an as-if metaphor. It's a metaphor that says, this is what it might feel like if you reach that self-transcendent state. It will feel like there's something other than you coming through you. That's not doctrine, because Buddhism would say, you could use another metaphor and say that it is you, it's always you, but it's you as you really are, you as you always kind of were. Had you not been deluded, had I not been deluded by my delusion of self? So there are different metaphors. Buddhism plays around with metaphors, so don't take any of them too literally. But this is a good one for various reasons. I'm probably not going to have time to go into all of the reasons why it's good. But it's a good one because, well, one of the reasons is this is what it might feel like. So then, what I started to explore last week was, how do you reach this self-transcendent state where you are filled with this energy of love, of compassion, of freedom, of bliss? This energy that, in a way, is the epitome of what every human heart yearns for. How do we make way for that? How do we do that? And in this particular paper, Subhuti and Sangharakshita Bhante, talked about three conditions for the arising of the suprapersonal force. Three conditions. I talked about the first condition last week. I'll recap on it a bit. I touched on the second, but we'll touch on it more. And then there's a third one, which I didn't really mention. So the first one is individual practice, that we have to practice working on our own hearts and minds. And the in this paper, the guidelines for that are what the Buddha taught as the threefold path. The threefold path of ethics, of meditation, and then wisdom. Or in Sanskrit, it's sila, samadhi, prajna. Sila, samadhi, prajna. Ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And last week we talked about how that path, that again it's a model, but that model of a path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom reverses the deluded structure of our consciousness. Our deluded structure of consciousness, the way it sort of seems to operate is that at the heart there's this wrong assumption that there's a real fixed me in here, in a real fixed world out there. That root delusion, which is pre-conscious, it's instinctive, it's not just a rational thought out thing, it's a gut level instinct. That root delusion gives rise to self-centered mental states based on greed and hatred, and then out of those mental states we act in self-centered, selfish ways and cause more harm. We reinforce the delusion and we can hurt others in the process. So that structure is reversed by ethics, meditation, and wisdom. Ethics emphasizes particularly our behavior and our speech and our actions and relations with others. You know, working on those self-centered behaviors. Meditation takes it more deep and starts to work on those self-centered states of mind, you know, through things like the metta-bhavana and the mindfulness of breathing. And then wisdom practice, which is based on reflection, starts to work on the delusion itself, to see through the delusion itself. So sila, samadhi, prajna reverses that trend in consciousness which keeps us confined. So that's the first condition, which I touched on last week. I talked about last week. But interestingly, what Subhuti and Sangharakshita say is that it's generally not enough just to be working on our own minds in that way and our own behaviours in that way. Generally, for most of us, that's not enough. Of course, if our practice of sila, samadhi, prajna went deep enough, if it was intensive enough, then it would be enough. But for most of us, it's not enough. It's not enough. And one of the dangers of it, and this is a danger of Buddhism misunderstood, is that even our practice of sila, samadhi, prajna, even our sort of sincere practice of the Dharma, can be subtly self-centered. It can still be about me wanting to improve me and my life. Of course, that's not altogether a bad motivation, particularly when we're starting to practice. Probably it's the motivation that most of us have when we first come to the Dharma. I want to be happier. That's you know, not bad. It's not a problem. But if the goal of the Dharma life is to transcend all notion of me, then can you see how at some point, even me wanting to be happy and practicing sincerely can become a self-fulfilling trap? Do you see what I mean? It's not enough of its own. If we're too concerned about my meditation practice or my ethical behaviour. So for example, in Sri Ratna, we really encourage people to be vegetarian. And if you can, to be more than vegetarian, to be vegan. So there's an encouragement to really look at the ethics of eating and trying to minimize harm where we can. But you can sometimes meet people in the Sangha who are sort of vegetarian or vegan in a rather angry way and want to bash you on the head with their practice of, well, veganism particularly is how I sometimes come across it. It's a really good thing to do to be vegan, but frankly, if you're going to hate people for not being vegan, you're undermining this very good thing. You know, good as it is for cows, it's not really great for other people if you hate them, or for yourself actually. So that would be just a slightly trivial example of even the practice of ethics becoming too much about me. Do you see what I mean? Or me and some cows, in this case. But it's still rather self-referential. We've somehow got to break out of our self-referential world. Really difficult to do. Fortunately, there are loads of opportunities to do that. Those opportunities are other people. Other people are not me. And every other person, therefore, that I meet is an opportunity for me to break out of my tiny little self-referential world and connect with another human being or other human beings. So this second condition that Subhuti gives is service, serving others, serving something bigger than ourselves, giving, altruism, generosity, love, metta in action, not just on the cushion. This sort of service is an essential aspect of a Dharma life that's really going to break the bonds of self and self-centeredness. Yeah. Without that, it still remains a project for me. So this is the second condition. And of course, there are an infinite number of ways of serving, of being kind, of being generous, of being altruistic, of being helpful in the world. There's no sort of limit to it, and there's no prescription to it. And probably all of us are doing it to some degree or other. All that I'm trying to say is that we can all probably, no matter how much we think we're doing, we can probably make that practice a little bit more conscious, perhaps a little bit more effective. We can probably all improve in our ability to empathize, to love, to give, to connect, to serve. But one of the challenges that Subhuti in this paper talks about is that as a Buddhist, the highest gift that a Buddhist can give is the gift of the Dharma. As Buddhists, we value the Dharma as the highest gift because it's the Dharma that is going to lead. The Dharma as truth is going to lead to this liberation. And that liberation, this transcendent consciousness, is the most beautiful, fulfilling thing that you can do with your life, that any human being can do with their lives. It's almost, one's almost tempted to say, well, I often do say, that it seems to be what life is for. When you think about what life is for, probably all of us would agree that it can't be for getting more material goods. Clothes, houses, cars. It probably can't be for just having a better and better, more hedonistic time. Holidays, drink, drugs, parties. All of that might be all right, but if you really want to see what life is for, then probably most of us would say, yep, yeah, there's got to be more. There's got to be more. And the Dharma is saying there is more, and it's pointing to what that more is, and it's saying that what that more ultimately is this self-transcendent state, where this force comes through us, and it is a force of love, of compassion, that connects us with all life. And while we're in that state, there's, in a sense, sense of being separate dissolves. And that is ultimately fulfilling and liberating. So given that ultimate purpose, what Subhuti and Sangharakshita say is that if you can, then serve the Dharma. Of course, serve in other ways. There are many ways that you can help in the world, help others in the world. But if you can, then do it in a way which serves the Dharma. Partly because of pragmatic reasons. I've just given you a sort of, I've tried to give you a deeper, almost philosophical reason as to why the Dharma is so important. But even from a practical and pragmatic perspective, there aren't very, very many people who are spreading the Dharma in the world. And the reason that there aren't very many people is that there aren't very many people comparatively really practicing the Dharma. And you've got to be practicing it in order to spread the Dharma or serve the Dharma. So if you are practicing the Dharma, then help serve the Dharma by helping others to practice the Dharma. That's what's being got at here. And that can be in any number of ways. So for example, at this Buddhist centre, we rely on volunteers. So everybody here is a volunteer, from people teaching like me to people helping run this class to people leading retreats, etc., or working in the office, etc. Some of those volunteers do get some financial contribution allowance, but the way we see it is that financial allowance isn't a wage; it's more a support to enable them to carry on living, so that they can give. So it's like a stipend or something like that. That's one example of giving from. And people are volunteering all the time here, from sitting on the reception desk to, you know, and answering phones, etc., to cleaning at the centre or doing the admin or whatever it is. Let me just pause there. So I've said quite a bit. I've said that one metaphor for talking about the enlightened state is to talk of it in terms of a force. And that force is best described as something more than personal, a transcendent force coming through us. And then the conditions that lead to that arising of a suprapersonal force, first of all, are practicing on our own minds through the threefold path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And then, in addition to that, having an aspect of service in our lives, and maybe particularly if we can, serving the Dharma. So let me pause and see if there are any questions or thoughts that come to mind from that. Yeah, hi.
Mm. In that I have family commitments which I need to honour in various durations.
Yeah.
And to stop them being routine duty.
Yeah.
The actual practice of meditation, and particularly that of Arpa, is really, really helpful. And so that's a really I need both to
exactly.
To then I can actually give loving.
Yes.
I think there's a strong kind of argument to go right
Exactly, exactly. I think that's really important. That's such a good point. It's an essential point, actually. I'm glad you raise it. That the two things that I've, these two conditions are mutually reinforcing. They although I've put them, although I've described them as one following the other in a sequential way, actually they're not. They're, in a way, they're not even that separate. They are mutually reinforcing. So, for example, you said that in order to give and serve the people around you and your family that need help, in order to do that still open-heartedly rather than somehow resentfully or forced way, meditation really helps you, and the metta bhavana really helps you. And so that's an example where working on your mind directly can really help you give. And then there's a reciprocal effect. When you give, you're practicing metta in action, and then that will really help your meditation practice. Because if we're not practicing metta in our everyday lives, when we come to sit on the cushion, it's going to be much more difficult to cultivate a sense of metta. If we're used to acting from kindness, then when we sit on the cushion, it'll come naturally. Yeah. So they reinforce each other, and then they're needed together. Yeah. So thank you for raising that. Yes. Yes.
Just immensely comforting.
Yes.
Experience.
Yes. So
that I can take out with me and just hold till next week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very sort of simple, but very comforting.
And that's also a lovely image when you said that it felt as if you were lungs and the world was breathing in and out of you. Again, that's a metaphor, that's an image, a very lovely image in a way, of something coming through you that you're not doing, you're not forcing, you're not controlling. It's life coming through us, life breathing through us. And that's very, very analogous to this idea of love, of a force of love coming through us. Yeah, nice. Great to hear. Thank you. Yes.
So obviously, sometimes there's a trapism because the purpose is to see past the ego, but sometimes giving is egotistical or helping.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
So the metta is sometimes means not helping. Doesn't it mean saying no? They're feeling that they're doing things they don't want to do to give to other people in their families or whatever, in a way that it's okay, I'm putting up with this now because I'm actually giving and it's better for them. And actually the meta, if you could have a bigger bird's eye view of everything, would be to not give and to deal with the consequences of that. Just let life be itself.
Some of that I'd agree with, and some of that I wouldn't. What I would agree with is that it's probably not, on the whole, helpful to give if it's going to lead you to resentment. And also, perhaps more subtly than that, if you haven't really got the resources, inner or outer, to give, then probably it's wise to say, I can't give at the moment. Yeah, if you haven't got those resources. Part of what meditation does is it builds up those inner resources so that you can give more. But if you're depleted on those resources, then in a way you're not in a position to give, and to give out of a feeling of guilt doesn't help. Nor does giving in Buddhism have the connotations of becoming a martyr. So if you've got a tendency to martyr yourself and then get resentful of others, if that is a tendency, then you have to be wise to that and find a way of curbing that. And for a while, that might mean at times having boundaries and saying, I can't do this, or no, I'm not going to do this. So there is an intelligence that's needed around giving that takes account of our capacities. Where I would disagree with you is, but perhaps you didn't mean this, so let me just, forgive me for sort of interpreting what you might have meant, and I'll just give you what my version is. Where I would disagree, though, is that the ideal would be to be have a plenitude of resources inside you and be able to spontaneously share and give. The ideal wouldn't be to be boundaried and to have to say no. What where we're moving to is having an abundance of resources inside us, of kindness, of love, of energy, so that we can share it and give. But along the way, you have to be intelligent about where the boundaries might need to be.
If somebody may be asking for something from you, and you can get into this route, oh, I will give. But you might be giving to something,
yes.
And that could actually create harm for them.
So yes.
You don't know, it's hard to know what... You don't, if you switch giving autopilot on, you're not necessarily helping the people necessarily. You're just reacting in a way without coming into your being as to is this helpful, is it not helpful? Lots of things. I mean, children will want to eat sweets until they're sick,
yes,
won't they?
Yes.
Say, give me some sweets, give me some sweets.
Yes.
And if your autopilot's on, you're giving them sweets until they're sick, and they've lost their teeth and they've got diabetes. So it's hard to know. It's not hard to know. It's, kind of,
it's quite easy to know in that case. In that case. But. But in another sense, yes, it might not be so easy to know. I think, let me respond, and then I'm going to move on, because I'd like to move on to either other questions or other areas.
Yeah.
But you're completely right in saying that you need, what I would say is that you're saying, is that you need intelligence with giving. You need intelligence to know what will be helpful. So I think that's another area that you're bringing out that's very apposite. It's good. But what I'm emphasising at the moment is, yes, by all means be discerning and intelligent about how you give and what you give. But what I'm emphasising is that all of us could do with being more open-handed and more open-hearted. Yeah? And it's that bit. And one of the things I was saying recently is that if we're too quick to worry about whether it's a good idea to give or not, it can become an excuse to not be more open-hearted. And we need to be... If we're going to move to this ultimate fulfilment and liberation, then it's in our interest to give. We need to learn to give more in order to open our hearts. Now, I completely take your point that that needs to be intelligently done. But for most of us, unless we're already well on the way to enlightenment, most of us need to open our hearts more. And giving is a way of doing that. And if you're intelligent about it, it doesn't need to deplete you. Yeah? And it can be helpful for others. So shall we move on to the third of these? Who's that? So it's Rail, you were pointing, but I don't know who to. Oh, hello.
I was just, I don't know if I misunderstood, but I was just thinking, I was feeling a little bit uncomfortable with the idea of serving the Dharma as the highest form of service, or a form of service that's more valuable, just because there's so... I mean, I understand the sort of the pragmatic argument, but it seems like there's so many people who are in a place of crisis.
Yes, I agree.
For whom, you know, Buddhism is probably a little bit far away in terms of priorities.
No, that's right. And I think I was saying in the tea break that, you know, if you for example, haven't got your basic material needs met, of food and shelter, and then in a way it's no good trying to teach somebody to meditate. That's not what they need. So I agree that there are some, you know, there are people in crisis, and if we can help them, then I think we should. Fortunately, there are people who are helping those people, but probably not enough, and, you know, the need is greater than the help. All I'm trying to say is not to make it an either-or thing, but to say that also there's an existential crisis for many people. And particularly in our modern culture, a lot of people have their material needs fairly well met, but their sort of existential needs, their loneliness, their sense of isolation, their sense of meaninglessness in life, there aren't that many solutions being offered, intelligent solutions to that. And you see that in our culture in the rise of mental health issues, depression being a very pertinent one. And those sorts of, that sort of suffering is also acute, and there aren't, as I say, that many people addressing that. Now, of course, there are, I mean, people are addressing that. You know, you've got doctors and medical professions and psychologists, etc., addressing it on a particular level, particularly if you talked about mental illness. But somewhere along the line, I think that there's still a question about meaning, what is life for, that a lot of people are feeling the absence of. And maybe 100 years ago, in a country like ours, religions like Christianity would have answered that need. A lot of people would have thought, okay, Christianity gives our lives meaning. God gives our lives meaning. There's a direction, a purpose, an aim in life. Many, many people have lost faith in traditional theistic religions, and yet they also see that our secular life isn't enough. Our secular life seems to add up to not a lot more than can I grab more material things and make myself more comfortable, my family more comfortable. And many, many people are feeling that's not enough. I was reading today about the Kent County Council are doing some, they're going to put resources into exploring how to prevent suicide. They found that this last year, the suicide rate in Kent was higher than it's ever been, particularly amongst men. And, you know, they want to put some more resources into that. I think there is this, I mean, that's just one example and a rather sort of particular one. But I think that's what's been got at here, is that there's an existential need that we also have. Not to deny that many, many people have more material, urgent material needs. Yeah. So helping in any way is great. Yeah? But this one's highlighting the Dharmic perspective. So they're the first two conditions, and there's a third one which I want to come on to. So the third one is to develop a lifestyle to intelligently try and cultivate a lifestyle, a life, where you can practice the Dharma and serve, where it's possible for you to do that. Yeah? Because so much of the time, what prevents us from doing these things, we know they're a good idea, we know it's a good idea to meditate, etc., etc., to go on retreat. But our lifestyle, the life that we've set up for ourselves, or maybe the life that we find ourselves in doesn't allow it. Doesn't allow it. So I was just talking to somebody in a tea break, and he said he'd really like to go on a retreat, he can't get time off. He's not going to be able to get time off. Now, we didn't have time to really explore that, and it might be nothing that he can do about it. But many of us find ourselves living a particular life where the things that we know are going to be really valuable for us, we find there's no room for. Yeah? There's no room for. Now, sometimes those conditions that make up our life are beyond our control, particularly if we've got family, parents or children who need our help, if we're a carer particularly. There's, I can see a lot of objective demands on us, on our time, on our energy, etc. But much of the time, for many of us, there is a degree of choice involved in what sort of life are we living? Where are we prioritizing our time and our energy? Yeah? And this third condition is to really look at that and see if we can cultivate a more helpful, conducive lifestyle. And normally that's going to mean simplifying our life. Simplifying our life so that we have more time, so that we've got more energy, more space. But it might mean simple things like, I'm leading a study group at the moment, and the people in that study group are fairly new to meditation, and they're finding that if they drink alcohol, it affects their meditation practice. And it's one thing for me to say, oh, that will happen, but it's quite another to discover it for yourself. I know that when I discovered it for myself, I felt, oh no, look, I really value this meditation practice. And even just drinking a moderate amount affects my mind the following day and possibly the day after. And I decided I wanted to stop, not out of some guilt or wanting to be good or please anybody. I was just gaining from something else, and this seemed a good thing to do. As I did that, as I stopped drinking socially, which would normally occupy probably three evenings a week, with work colleagues, I found I had more time. And then I could come here and do more classes and meditate more. And that was proving more enjoyable. Now, I was in a fortunate position of having the freedom to do that. And it's just an example of a little bit of a change that some of us might be able to make that could support our meditation practice. It's said sometimes that when you first come to learn to meditate, you probably have in mind that you want to learn to meditate to improve your life. So you want to make changes to your meditation practice to improve your life. And then you find after a while that you start improving your life, changing your life so that you can meditate more. And that is not an uncommon kind of experience. So look at your lifestyle. Look at your lifestyle. Where can you make changes if you have a choice to support your practice, both your practice and your ability to serve others? So I'm fortunate enough to live in a community. I live above here at the very top of the building with 7 other people, men who are practicing Buddhism. Well, it's fantastic to live with friends who are also trying to practice the Dharma. So when I sit down to meditate, or when I want to, or when I'm trying to be generous or kind, there's encouragement for that. Or we take it in turns to cook for each other. So I only have to cook 3 times a month. And the rest of the time, all my meals are made ready for me. It saves a lot of time. It's great. I mean, that's just a small but very important consideration. We have dessert every night. That's a small and more important consideration for me. It's a very, very... very lovely way to live. Now, in choosing that lifestyle, I have decided that I don't want a house of my own or a flat of my own. So I have a room of my own in a communal environment. And of course, there are pros and cons. Sometimes I think, wouldn't it be great to have more space, a garden, do you know what I mean? A lovely, lovely flat, etc., etc. But actually, when I look at the priorities of my life, I gain more from this simplifying. Or some years ago, I decided that for me, my career had wasn't fulfilling me anymore, and I was able to downsize and downshift and all of those ways, and come and work here at the Buddhist Center. Again, I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. And at the time, lots of my colleagues kept saying how, how courageous that was, and it did take a little bit of courage, but also how they'd love to do that if they only could. And I know some of them couldn't because they had kids to support, and you know, you can't just chuck in your job if you've got kids. That you're supporting, but many of them could, and they could have done if they wanted to. So I'm just saying that there are lifestyle choices that sometimes we could make. So there's much more to say about that, much more to say about simplifying our lives, about, well, Buddhism uses the word renunciation. There's much more that we could look at, but I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to recap and say that these three conditions of practicing Sila, Samadhi, Prajna, ethics, meditation, wisdom, of serving, of being of service to others, and then trying to find a lifestyle that's conducive to those two things. They're fairly general, broad, universal conditions that are applicable to all of us if we're going to be if we're going to make serious progress at undoing the bonds of self. And if we can do that seriously, if we can make some sort of effort to do that, even if it's not all the time, even if we can have periods like going on retreat where all of those things happen, even if we can do it some of the time, what you start to see is that even before you break through the delusion of a fixed and separate self, even before that, you start to experience more joy and more freedom and more fulfillment, and more sense of empathy and connection with the world around you, and more sense of beauty and meaning in life. All of that unfolds if you practice in this way. And then perhaps there'll come a point where there's a breakthrough that happens, and it can be subtle or it can be dramatic, where it really does feel like something new has arisen in your consciousness, something that you can only describe as a force or an energy that's working through you. And then suddenly all that effort to cultivate love and kindness and empathy and freedom becomes spontaneous. And it feels like you just open up to a life beyond your life. And that is the fulfillment, or it leads to the fulfillment of, well, our human potential. So I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.